Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I probably should have been more scared than I was when I witnessed the exorcism.
I turned and looked on my right side. When I did, there's a beam on the side of the tree, a large beam. It's looking at me and I'm looking at it.
After I hit the lock button and looked back up, I saw red eyes staring back at me.
That they're going to show multiple gods all over the earth, be able to speak in people's languages. And at that point, it kind of converge into this one entity, which will be revealed as extraterrestrial. You'll realize that aliens are the gods of old. And at that point, it'll wipe religion out of the context of humanity.
No way. It couldn't have been a person. I know that. I know that people can't run through the woods like that.
So this thing comes into view, and I see it. It's 50 yards away from me. It's walking. It's walking on two legs. It's huge. This is a big, hairy looking being.
Welcome. I'm your host, and this is Uncomfortable.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. I am your host, Eric Szilagyi. If you've had an uncomfortable experience and you'd like to have it featured on the show, please get a hold of me at contact.uncomfortable@gmail.com. Now, some of you might be put off. I get messages from people that have these small little sightings or small little experiences. I still want to hear them. And if it's not quite enough to make a full episode out of it, get a hold of me. I'd like to record it and I'll put it in a file. And then when I get several things together, we'll just put together a hodgepodge of different experiences and release that as a show. So please don't be put off if you don't think your experience or your story is long enough to come on the podcast. I want to hear everything. That being said, make sure you follow us on Facebook and Instagram, both at Uncomfortable Podcast 65. Most importantly, please share the show with others and make sure you leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you can. That is so important in getting the show out in front of more people in the algorithms that produce recommended listens for people. If you have not yet joined the Discord server, please do. We would love to see you in there. You can find the link for that down in the show notes. It's been a lot of fun. I encourage you to get involved. Again, we'd love to see you there. Now, tonight's guest. What can I say about tonight's guest? A very accomplished woman. Tonight's guest is Amy Boo, co-founder of Project ZooBook, member of the Olympic Project Bigfoot Research Team. She's the head of Amy's Bucket List Expeditions, former investigator for Bigfoot Field Research Organization, the BFRO. She's a writer, educator, and editor from Ohio. She became interested in the search for Bigfoot after seeing something strange in Ohio's Mahoning County in 2012. While her main research areas are the Forest County, Pennsylvania, It's Allegheny National Forest and Ohio's Columbiana County. Amy has traveled into Michigan, New York State, Kentucky, Oregon, Washington State, West Virginia, Texas, Arkansas, and all over Ohio. Much of Amy's efforts have been put into her Project Zoo Book, a group she co-founded and coordinates comprised of primate zookeepers, primatologists, wildlife biologists, marine biologists, forest workers, forestry workers, archaeologists, anthropologists, university professors, law enforcement officials, taxonomists, and other scientists working alongside Bigfoot researchers from across the country. Man, if that's not a mouthful. And if that's not all, her bio reads like a grocery list of additional things. I will post that in the notes. It's too extensive to go into here. If you guys are ready, I know I am. Let's get into it. Now, if you will, ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm, uncomfortable welcome to Miss Amy Boo. Amy, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I've heard your name for a few years now. It's been around. How long have you been doing this?
What year is it? 2023. I have been interested in Bigfoot since 2012, like really interested in Bigfoot. You know, heard about it and all that kind of stuff. Before that, as has everyone pretty much who lives in America, but wasn't caught up in it or interested at all until about 10 and a half years ago.
Well, you know, you're doing speaking engagements and and you're heading, you're part of the Olympic project, which anybody who knows anything about Bigfootery is going to recognize that. So you've kind of, I mean, since 2012, you've kind of been on the fast track, as it were, to get to where you are and what you're doing now. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, sometimes you talk to, and here's another part of why I'm really interested in talking to some of the female side of Bigfoot investigation. You know, like my show, I cover all of high strangeness. So typically, Bigfoot, I end up having an interview with a guy, right? Mm-hmm. And typically, yeah. if it's something to do with spirituality or a witch or something of that nature, it always ends up being a female. And it's not by design. It just seems to be the way things roll out to me. But, you know, I've tried getting a hold of Mariah Mayer, and you know, I'm sure she is extraordinarily busy, and why would she want to mess with a small town podcast like this? But I'm really, really interested in getting a different perspective on it, and I think the information that you have is just as valuable as, you know, any other researcher. I mean, you just pretty much take gender completely out of it.
I appreciate that.
So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to get into, you know, back in 2012, what prompted you? What was the impetus behind you getting interested? Was there an occurrence? I know there was, but you know, for the listeners, if you wouldn't mind getting into that, and then let's get into some of your background as far as, you know, working your way into being a naturalist and your position there in Ohio. I know one of the interviews I listened to, you said you used to spend some time at near the Ohio Bigfoot Conference held there at Salt Fork State Park. And that's a pretty interesting area because, you know, Ohio is recognized as a hot spot, you know, and even over there into Pennsylvania. And that whole east side, I mean, I've talked with Mike Familant from Shadow of the Big Red Eye out there, and he's in Jersey for of all places. You know, he's tracking them up in northern Jersey. So go ahead and tell everybody what started this all for you.
Sure. And for what it's worth, I think it's crazy, all the things I'm doing right now, too. It's just like Bigfoot's kind of taken over my life in some ways. But yeah, it all started back in 2012. I was a passenger in a car going over Meander Reservoir, which is here in Mahoning, Ohio. And Bigfoot, I always say, was the last thing on my mind, because I had just been to see my father before he died. And it was really the last time I got to talk to him. I knew he was very sick. You know, we weren't sure what was going to happen there. So Bigfoot was not on my brain. But I looked out the window as we were going over this bridge that I've gone over so many times before. And I saw something standing along the shoreline. And what drew my attention there was there's these big blocks in the water, and there's oftentimes like seabirds, even though we're in Ohio, that are flying around on them and sitting on them. And I've seen those my whole life, those birds. But this time, the one that was closest to the block that was closest to the shore, there were all these birds flying all over the place, just making like a crazy ruckus out there. And so my eye was drawn to that, because I hadn't really seen that before. And as I looked toward them, my eye was drawn over to the left of that on the shore, like because that was the closest to the shore, if I didn't already say that. Anyway, there was a figure standing there, and I was like, well, that's really weird, because I've never ever seen anybody in Meander Reservoir. And there's all like a bunch of jokes about that, because everybody wants in there to fish. You know, everybody would love to go in there, but it is the city's water supply, and so you're not allowed in there. And I'm like, huh, you know, somebody's there. But as we were getting closer, and this all, you know, didn't take very long, it's not a huge bridge or anything, but as we were getting closer, I'm looking at it, and I'm like, that does not look like a person. I'm saying this internally. And I'm staring at it. Just what is that? And the closest we got was probably about 100 yards. And I'm horrible at distances. Somebody else told me that it was probably 100 yards afterwards when I was telling them where it was. And so, you know, people often ask me if I've had Bigfoot sightings and what, you know, what prompted my interest. And I'm like, I don't know what it was. I don't know. I cannot claim that that was a Bigfoot sighting. But what I will tell you is it looked to me like what Bigfoot would look like if you were looking at Bigfoot from that distance standing there. Because it was all one color, like a dark color. No variation for clothing. And when I think of a football field, I think about that 100-yard distance. And I think I'd be able to tell, even though it's far, I think I'd be able to tell a person, you know, like that they were wearing jeans or whatever, and that they were a human being. But, you know, I didn't see any evidence of clothing. I knew it was alive and not some kind of a cutout or something like that, because it was holding on to a tree, and then it moved looking, what I interpreted as looking out toward those birds, like it was facing that way. So it did move. It didn't walk or anything like that. It was just standing there. And, you know, I'm just staring at it thinking, what in the world is that? And as we drove by, I yelled out, I think I just saw Bigfoot. You know, and then I was like, well, that's stupid. But that's what it looked like to me. So the driver didn't.
What was the reaction from the rest of the passengers when you said that?
Well, my daughter was lying down in the back seat. She didn't see anything. My ex-husband was driving, and he's just like, okay, he didn't see it. You know, I never said anything as we were going toward it, because I was just like, what is that? You know, like, just couldn't process it, really. And then after I yelled it, you know, and I'm like, pretty much right away thought that was really dumb, that could, there's no such thing as Bigfoot. And if there was such a thing as Bigfoot, it wouldn't be there. You know, I'm sure he thought that I was like mistaken, although he humored me and everything. But, you know, I don't know what it was, but it was significant enough that I called my mom pretty quickly after that. I'm like, Mom, I think I saw Bigfoot. And I always will say that that, whatever that was, it was the impetus that made me start looking into this. So I don't know what it was. I can't say for sure, but it struck me and affected me enough that it really changed my life. I don't know how else to say that, because it sent me down this rabbit hole that I never would have thought I would ever go down or be speaking about or researching or anything like that. So, sure. Yeah, so I'm not sure what that was, but it is absolutely the thing that got me started in this, because I can't get that out of my head. I still think about what that was that I saw. And now that I talk to other people and get other people's reports, I've had several reports from that same area.
Oh, and really? That same water source?
That same water source. And people that have said they've seen things way up close. Like, there's one lady who said she saw one there with a duck in its mouth, you know, and was sure of what she saw. So,
with a duck in its mouth.
I know. That's the first time I heard something like that. And somebody saw one close to there holding a dead deer. So there have been a lot of sightings in that area. I had no clue at that time. I didn't know that anybody really thought Bigfoot was real.
Yeah.
You know, like that, or that it could be. I just had no concept of any of this. So it was just a big shock.
So up until that point, Bigfoot was not on your radar at all, for the most part.
Not at all. I mean, I feel like a pretty typical person where I used to watch In Search Of when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I saw Harry and the Hendersons, you know. I did a report when I was in school, a young teenager, about the Loch Ness Monster.
I did too.
You did? Yes. Had us do one on like something we weren't sure if we believed in it or not, so I chose that. And I do remember there was like one book in the library at school, and it did have a chapter about Bigfoot, but I never read it. So no, it was not on my radar, not something I was interested in at all. So whatever that was that I saw, Bigfoot or not, it sent me into this crazy new hobby, if you want to call it that, or passion or quest or whatever, that I never would have thought I would have. So
it's crazy. It's crazy. Awesome. The number of people that I have talked to who have brought up that same book and that being one of their first experiences with, because the book that we had in our school, I want to say that it was like, it was a thinner book. A pocketbook, and half of it was about Bigfoot and half of it was about the Loch Ness Monster.
Yes. I don't remember the name of it. In my brain, I want to say like it was something like, not like Time Life, but something like that. Maybe, I don't know, but I just remember it was a very thin book.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, maybe the Yeti, you know, I can't remember, because I just read the Loch Ness Monster part because I had to write the report. And we didn't have the internet back then.
Right. Yeah, we did not. I think in ways, you know, obviously it's, you've got everything at your fingertips now, which is great and a huge time saver. But I think it makes for lazy people, because we used to have to actually crack open books and you know, that, yes. I don't know.
As a language teacher, it's always an uphill battle.
Okay, so you have this sighting of this thing that you
that doesn't make sense.
Right.
You're not really able to relate it to anything else you've seen. And what happens then? What happens that tweaks your interest so hard that you end up going and becoming a member of one of the larger Bigfoot research projects, the Olympic project? You know, I mean, how does that all play out? I mean, there must be a tremendous drive there, as far as you wanting to find answers or at least help be a part of, an investigative team.
Right. Well, there's definitely a path that happened, and it's kind of funny you put it that way, because I often tell my friends that, like, I feel like this path kind of opened. like I've had a lot of opportunities that have come my way that I never would have expected. So part of it is a lot of time and hard work. And part of it is, whether you want to say luck or blessings or whatever, that have opened doors to me. But what happened basically is, I couldn't stop thinking about that thing I had seen. And by that time, we did have the internet. So I started searching, like, Bigfoot, okay, and Bigfoot sightings and Bigfoot Ohio and just all these different things. And I was absolutely shocked about how much information there was, and about that there's this whole thing, like this whole Bigfoot phenomena going on that I never was aware of before. So kind of it started partly as a human interest type of thing, like, what in the world are these people doing, or what are they saying they've seen? You know, could this actually have any kind of truth in it? And partly I just got hooked in the excitement of it, I guess. The first thing I did, I think you asked, the first thing I did was I started reading. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of things online and different reports and things, but I mostly started going to the library and getting all the books that I could possibly find about it. So I right away went to some really good sources, you know, Dr. Meldrum's book and things from Dr. Bindernagel and things from Grover Krantz and all of the people who were looking at this from a scientific viewpoint, which I am not a scientist, but that's kind of how I think. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, like, these really smart people are saying that. Some of them are saying that it's possible that these exist, and some of them are saying that they really believe that these exist. So I started reading everything I could. Then I started going to see other people who would speak about it. And it's funny now, you know, that's something that I do at libraries and different things like that, because I started going, like, showing up and maybe kind of in the back of these talks, just listening to the different witnesses give their reports. And it always struck me that when you hear a real life person, you know, tell their story, a lot of them were very believable.
Yeah.
And I just was surprised by that. I'm like, man, these people don't seem like nutcases or anything like that. They don't seem like they're, you know, just way out there. They seem like normal people.
Yeah.
So I just read as much as I could. I started going to hear other people. And it just kind of evolved from there.
Well, you know, you talk about speaking in front of people, you know, libraries and stuff like that. I had an opportunity, and this was already in the mix. I was already planning on doing this. I hosted Bigfoot and Brews this past September in the Dewey Lake Monster area. It's okay. A brewery that's right there in Sister Lakes, and, you know, we were a mere mile and a half away from where the sightings were from 64. But prior to that, a couple months before that, in mid-spring, I think it was, I was asked to come up to the West Branch Bigfoot Discovery Days, and they, I was asked if I would host the town hall meeting. Mm-hmm. So, excuse me, that's exactly what I ran into with speaking with, you know, four gentlemen that came up, and very normal people. They're not weirdos. They're not eccentric. They're not, you know, they were just normal people. And right. In my episode 2 and 3, I got to interview a family that is merely 20 minutes away from my house, just over the Michigan state line. And that interview was really, really amazing. You know, I actually knew the gentleman well enough that he invited me to his home, and we sat at his dining room table to do that interview. And I sat across from him and his two daughters, and I looked at them in the eye the whole time we talked, you know, and I saw the body language. I saw, I didn't see their eyes darting around looking for, oh my God, what am I going to say next? There was none of that. It was very, very organic. And, you know, when we got done, his daughters both gave me a hug and said how wonderful it was to be able to talk about every aspect of that without getting interrupted and without getting eyes rolled at you and, you know, making you feel weird for it. But the thing that was really, really compelling for me was the wife and the mother. She did not want to be a part of the recording. But yet we talked afterwards, and I got to hear from her the ramifications of what those three saw. Right. And how the one daughter ended up having to seek therapy because she couldn't get the eyes out of her head. Every time she'd sit down near a piece of paper or a pencil, she'd be drawing these eyes. And, you know, it was very moving. Mm-hmm. And I would put that up against anybody who wants to say, oh, they didn't see that didn't happen. You know?
No, I absolutely understand what you're saying, because now that I take a lot of reports, and my favorite, I still do speak at different Bigfoot events. I think that West Branch one was the one I was just recently asked to speak at, but it's the same weekend as another one I'm already doing. I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah.
Pretty sure that it was that one. So maybe someday, hopefully, yeah, I can make it there. But my favorite thing that I do now is I speak at different outdoor shows. So like hunting and fishing shows. I have several of those coming up here in February and March and beyond. And I get a lot of people who say exactly what you just said, where they appreciate being listened to because they're not people that are going to Bigfoot things. Mm-hmm. Big conferences or anything like that, and they haven't had, some of them have not had the chance to talk to somebody who was even just giving them the benefit of the doubt, let alone saying, you know, I believe you, or right, you know, yeah, this could be real. So I've had grown men that have cried, you know, that have told me about what happened to them and how it affected their entire lives. So I hear you. It's very powerful.
And, you know, and I saw it on a pretty large scale, because this family that I was telling you about from episodes 2 and 3, you know, it took several times of talking to them, but when they found out that I was hosting Bigfoot and Brews, they wanted to come. And I said, you know, you're not going to be around trolls. Nobody's going to pay $40 to come sit, listen to a bunch of Bigfoot people talk about Bigfoot and sit there and make fun of them. You know, they'll get stoned. So, I said, you know, you guys are more than welcome. Come, you know, you're going to be in company of people that are already, very interested in this stuff, if not already believing and possibly have already had experiences. So I think it'll be a good group for you to be around. And as it got closer, they agreed to get up and talk in front of everybody. And my my main speaker was Ron Moorhead.
Wow. I love Ron. He's a great guy.
He is. He's a phenomenal guy. I absolutely, I adore him. You know, the time we got to go after it was all over and done with, my son and I took him and his son out for dinner, and he wouldn't let me pay. And we just, to sit at a table and just have normal conversation with Ron Moorhead.
Right. He's such a good guy.
Was just a bizarre, it was a bucket list thing that I didn't know I had a bucket list for.
I know what you mean. I was out speaking with him in Medellin Falls, Washington this past summer, and we stayed in the same hotel, which was kind of, I mean, it had these, you each had your own room, but you shared bathrooms and all this stuff. And so, like, I just see him walking down the hall with his wife, and then I was kind of their chauffeur because I had a rental car and they didn't, so we would go around and see the sights, and it was just like,
you know, it's crazy, isn't it? Close, but
it was. They're just such nice, down-to-earth people. Really are.
Very pleasant, very pleasant. But the thing I guess I was getting at was when, you know, I mean, it was Ron Moorhead. He was the lead speaker at Bigfoot and Brews. And when that family, the dad and both daughters, got up and told their story, they stole the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it was amazing to see, you know, 150 or 160 people sitting there and just glued to every word that they were saying.
Right.
And even Ron went over and talked to them after they had gotten done, you know, and I saw him sitting at their table and having a conversation about it afterwards. It was truly amazing.
Yeah. It's really exciting. I love that.
So where do we go from here? How does one end up with the Olympic project? And I mean, you know, you're telling me you're out speaking, you know, out in Washington and places like that. You're covering the U.S. pretty much.
Yeah, I've been blessed to do so. Well, I'll tell you, we'll go in chronological order here. it's my teacher brain coming out. So I got interested, started going to hear other people. Flash forward a little bit of time, I guess. I used to help with some different events and met some people there. And was asked to join the BFRO in Ohio. So the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. Mm-hmm. And I was super excited about that. I knew a lot of really good people in there. And I was like, okay, yes, I want to do this. So I joined the BFRO, worked with them for several years, taking other people's reports. So I kind of got in the trenches there because a lot of people that are familiar with the BFRO don't understand or don't realize that there are a lot of reports that are sent in that never see the light of day. And most of those reports don't see the light of day because they, like somebody didn't leave their phone number or they can't get a hold of them. And they don't put anything out there unless they're vetted. And, you know, you have to actually make contact with the person, interview them, get more information, you know, and get those out. And so a lot of what I did was kind of cleaning up a lot of backlog reports. So I don't have that many reports that I did that are out on the BFRO's website because I was closing down a lot of reports that never couldn't make it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I spent several years doing that, met more people. And as far as the Olympic project goes, trying to remember what year it was, thinking 2016 or 2017, I can't remember, but I was at a conference and met a wonderful person named Barb Olvera, who was in the Olympic Project and the BFRO. And we just hit it off. I mean, it was really just kind of fortunate because we hit it off, just had a lot in common, and she invited me to come out there. So I went kind of as a non-official guest to one of their expeditions they had at the time. And she and I drove up there and fell in love with the research area that they have, the people. I mean, Shane Corson has become one of my best friends. I always say he's almost like a brother to me now. He and his wife, Summer, just have taken me in whenever I travel out there. Derek Randles is just such a good stand-up guy. And I just love how they tackle this mystery, I guess. Never, ever thought that they would ask me to be a part of their organization. But what happened then was maybe a year went by again. I'm getting my timing mixed up a little bit. But I had decided to step away from the BFRO. And I decided that I was just going to kind of do things on my own. By then, I had started my own group called Project Zoo Book, which is my baby. And just the thing that I love the most in all of this. And that has taken me from, you know, where I was at that point to this past summer. We took several of the Project Zoo Book members. We took a reporter from the Wall Street Journal out, and we're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. It's just been crazy, but it's just been like, I don't know if I want to call it coincidence again or luck or blessings or just hard work or what it is, but this maybe a little bit of all of it has just propelled me forward, I guess. So anyway, I decided to step away from the BFRO thinking I was never going to join another group. It just kind of wasn't for me, I thought. I just had my own way of doing things. I felt like there's just, you know, believe it or not, no matter where human beings gather, there can be drama, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I was like, I'm just going to kind of do my own thing. And so,
you know, and Bigfoot groups. Oh, mm-hmm. My God.
I know.
What a treacherous, horrible, horrible hell of a place that some of these Bigfoot Facebook groups and, you know, the horror stories that I've heard of from groups of individuals who have tried to, you know, collectively go out, like with, you know, as a group, like you're talking about.
Right.
I don't know what happens, but, you know, do you think, is it based on everybody, you know, gets an ego about themselves and they think they're going to be the next Matt Moneymaker, or the next, you know, Cliff and Bobo, or, you know, I mean, do they think that if they make enough noise that they're just going to get recognized as being, you know, quote unquote expert?
We interrupt this broadcast with breaking news. Manscaped now sells beard products. That's right. They are once again revolutionizing men's grooming with the brand new Beard Hedger Pro Kit. From a beard trim to a fresh shave, the technology behind the Beard Hedger Pro Kit allows you to shape your signature look. You can finally use Manscaped products to tame your facial squatchiness by going to manscaped.com and using the code UNCOMFORTABLE22 for 20% off and free shipping. As below, so above. At long last, gentlemen, you can now tame your mane. No one likes a weird and wild beard, so say goodbye to all your stubble troubles with Manscaped's Pro Beard Kit. In the spotlight, the Beard Hedger. Let me tell you, this thing is a wild man in fixing your facial ferocities. First off, the cordless trimmer has an adjustable rotary wheel giving you 20 cutting lengths, all in one guard. That's right, 20 lengths with just one guard. Plus, it's waterproof, so disquatchifying yourself is easier than ever in the shower. The titanium-coated T-blade is tough enough on hair but smooth on your face with efficiency and satisfaction, one stroke at a time. The Pro Kit doesn't end there. They have created four dermatologist-tested formulations for your post-trim care. Your beard hair is more coarse and easier to damage than the hair on your head. That's why the kit has the Beard Shampoo and Conditioner, specifically designed to moisturize, reduce ingrown hairs, replace natural oils, and promote beard health. Next, apply Manscaped's Beard Oil. No one wants a guy whose beard is brittle and dry. This oil relieves dryness on both the beard and the skin beneath, while adding a shimmer and shine, making you look extra fine. Finally, top off with Beard Balm, a pomade that shapes, styles, moisturizes, and tames for a sculpted look sure to attract any species of mate. The Pro Beard Kit also comes with three free gifts, a beard brush, comb, and scissors, to ensure your beard is impressive for anyone's sisters or misters. So get 20% off and free shipping with code UNCOMFORTABLE22 when you visit manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code UNCOMFORTABLE22. Manscaped, beard hedger, one stroke, one guard.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I think part of it is that for some people, I mean, I'll just say it, like, I almost got out of it a few years back because it was so stressful. You know, when I started speaking, people came out of the woodwork, like, how dare you have anything to say? You haven't been doing this long enough. And, you know, you can't be doing this. And, you know, and I was just so taken aback by all of it, because I'm like, I'm just a normal person. I'm a teacher from Ohio. I never set out to do anything like that, but I was asked, and I think maybe because I'm a teacher, I'm comfortable speaking in front of people, and I always enjoyed that. So I'm like, yeah, you know, one library asked me, and I'm like, okay, I'll do that. And then it just kind of snowballed. And it was never anything like, I still don't think I know more than anybody else. I'm not even 100% convinced that Bigfoot exists. You know, I think that they do. I absolutely believe that they could. Some days I'm positive they do. And other days, like, what am I wasting my time on, you know? But I am seriously, I lost really, really good friends over it. And so I do think that there's this weird phenomenon of people trying to be Bigfoot famous. And what's funny is that I was in Indiana. I had a table at an event in Indiana, and there were, you know, people like you're saying, you know, you're talking about Ron Moorhead, you know, Bob Gimlin was there. Just all kind of very actually Bigfoot famous people.
Sure.
But we all went to dinner that night, and it was just funny to me because everybody's jockeying for these different positions and stuff. And when we walked into that restaurant, nobody in that restaurant knew who Bob Gimlin was. You know, like, we knew, but nobody else knew who he was.
Who's that old cowboy?
I know. I mean, oh my gosh, do I love Bob. He's just such a wonderful, wonderful person. And he doesn't give a hoot if, whether the people knew him or not. I'm just using him as an example because who could there be more Bigfoot famous than that, you know? But I think people somehow have it in their head that they're really famous. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. Bob is.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, people of Bigfooting know who Bob is, but most of us who do anything, nobody cares. Nobody cares. So if you're going to like just be like a horrible human being over who gets to speak here or there, or even worse, like people that would say that I had no right to have a voice in it, well, it's pretty crappy, you know? So after saying all of that, because it was really bad, it took me a while to realize, like I said before, that wherever you have human beings, you're going to have drama. It doesn't matter if you have a knitting circle, you know? So it's not just Bigfoot. And I had to learn not to take things so personally, because, you know, there, like you said, there's different Facebook groups that people would just say these horrible things about me. And I'm like, oh man, if I was that interesting, you know, I'm not, I'm really not. I just made chili for supper and I had to grade a bunch of papers. I'm not that interesting to be like, you know what I mean? To be the topic of conversations. Sure. Nowadays, I'm not in very many groups and I purposely avoid a few of them. So.
Can I ask you a question about the BFRO?
Yes.
I posed this question to a still active member.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently in confidence, he told me that the answer to this question was a resounding yes.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to him was, are you aware of specific types of reports of these things that are being kept out of the public's ability to review them? Specifically, ones that would include anything that would be considered a violent encounter. And he said that, yes, that he was aware of reports that have been scrubbed and certain things omitted, or if nothing else, the entire report not being made
right
available.
Personally, I cannot remember anything like with violent reports like that. I'm racking my brain here and I can't, like, we were never told anything like that. Like, don't publish violent reports, or I never really came across them. I read a lot of reports and closed out a lot of reports in Pennsylvania, especially toward the end, and in Ohio. And I cannot recall any violent reports. Now, if you say, like more paranormal,
mm-hmm.
I would say yes. And that's not necessarily like a BFRO thing. It's some of the people in the BFRO thing. So I was told not to try to put through anything that sounded a bit off the wall, you know, like something that you just things that seemed less scientific.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like I have good friends in the BFRO. I respect them. I don't, you know, I just want to say that first of all, was it for me? No. And were some of the people for me? No. But again, that could be anywhere, but I don't know if I've ever said this in an interview before, but I'm going to say it. Why not? I did not agree with that. I look at Bigfoot as a possible primate, where it is on the spectrum of all the types of primates, I don't know. I also know that I don't know if that's true. Mm-hmm. And I also know that there are a lot of people who have experiences that don't kind of fit into that box.
Absolutely.
And so I didn't feel it was right to exclude those. And again, whether it was just my chain of command, I guess you want to say, that was saying we're not publishing those, we're staying away from those. I don't know. I only am familiar with Ohio and Pennsylvania and what was going on at that time. And things have changed a lot since I've been in there, and people have changed a lot. But I didn't feel comfortable with that because I felt like I still feel this way. Even in Project Zoo Book, we are a group of researchers and scientists. We're heavy on the scientists, but we have people that come in there like Ron Moorhead. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of what he talks about and believes, it doesn't fit very neatly into a mainstream science.
Sure.
But what he has to say is very interesting, and it's just as valid as any other hypothesis. You know, and I feel like you shouldn't, how do I want to say this? My interest is, could this be some type of an ape, some type of a primate? That's what keeps me going, because I think that would be really, really cool, right? But if somebody that's researching it differently finds out that that is the truth, I'm okay with that. Like, I think that would be fascinating, whether it's an alien or something supernatural or whatever. I'm like, that's just as fascinating. It's just not my particular interest. So if that's what it turns out to be, I probably would not be out there looking for it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Because it makes it a little less natural and a little more scary.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I would want it too. I'm just like being honest, but I just feel like science, there's so much science that we don't know how it works. And so just because something sounds odd doesn't mean it's not real. So shouldn't we be looking into that? And I didn't agree with that, I guess. And so, you know, the Olympic Project and Project Zoo Book are both heavy on the science. So I still am very interested in that. And that's what we're looking at. And that's what we're trying to figure out, you know, what's out there and what isn't out there. But nobody that I know of in those groups, like, makes fun of other people or anything like that. So I just feel like, I don't know, I think there's room for everybody. And I think it's really cool when I have really, really good friends who look at Bigfoot entirely different than I do. And they're very spiritual and all of that. And I think what they're doing is just as valid as what I'm doing. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, you said you think that this is a primate. It falls somewhere along the lines in with the primate.
I'm interested to know if it does. I don't know, but that's what I think it could be. I think it could be.
Do you entertain the thought that it could also be something that is much more closely related to a people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's okay. What I meant.
Like, okay.
Is it more toward a gorilla or an orangutan, or is it more toward a human? Yeah, I'm not sure. You get reports that sound like one or the other, kind of.
I tend to lean towards them being more of a people,
mm-hmm.
You know, those aspects, those humanish aspects to reports, you know. Now, I mean, you can watch videos of, I forget what the gorilla's name was that understood and could use sign language, and
yes,
Robin Williams was, you know, sitting around with her and everything.
Coco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. I think it was Coco. Yeah.
You watch that and she exhibits some human characteristics, mm-hmm. You know, but you go to a zoo and watch the chimps or the gorillas and they exhibit some human characteristics as well.
They sure do. Yeah. Some of the members of my group are primate specialists, and that's what they'll say is that when they first, you know, got to work up close and personal with a gorilla or a chimp, they just couldn't believe how human-like that they are.
Yeah.
You know, that this really shocked them in some ways. But yeah, I don't know which it would be more. What my very main reason why I think Bigfoot could be real, and some days think it is, is all of the Native American story.
That's what I always go back to as well.
Yes, and so they speak of them as people. We and some of the Project Zoo Book group got to go to the Blackfeet Reservation this past summer in Montana, and we camped with them and got to hear stories, and they took us to different spots where the Inamitipi, which is my very bad pronunciation of what they call Sasquatch, were seen to this day. So we were right outside Glacier National Park on their land and looking, you know, there was one over there and there was one over there. And they call them, you know, their brothers. They call them another group of people. And it was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had. We were listening to this beautiful Blackfeet chanting and singing, and they were talking about how the Inamitipi used to come to their like conclaves, if you want to say it, you know, to their meetings. And then when the humans started becoming too modern and leaving the old ways, they went back into the forests, but that they still look over them. You know, I just was sitting up there on that mountain thinking about that and looking at the forest and thinking, wow, like, it's just, it was magical. I don't know how else to put it, but they definitely think of them more as a people. On the flip side of that, when I think about, you know, orangutans or cross river gorillas or mountain gorillas or any of them that really were cryptids not that long ago, mm-hmm. you know, like they, Westerners didn't believe in them. The natives there, though, in Africa and Asia called them, you know, people, wild men and people of the forest and old man of the forest. And so I'm like, okay, so what's going on here? Is Sasquatch really more like a human, or is that their language? Like, you know, in Africa, they would call them wild men. So to them, they were a people, but they really were a gorilla. Does that make sense?
Sure, absolutely.
So I'm very, very curious about that. I don't know. I don't know which it is, but
that's
I'm very
curious. That's a good point. That is a very good point.
So, I don't know. It's fascinating, isn't it? It really is.
It is.
Really
you
is.
Know, and what's also fascinating is you still sitting here, you know, however many years in to your delving into this, and you are still not sure. It's a day-to-day thing for you, whether they, you think that they exist or that they don't. And, but the bottom line is you spend so much time steeped into this. And that's something that I've talked about in other shows. It's like, you know, you've got Ron Moorhead, 50 plus years of his life, you know, Bob Gimlin has been talking about this for how many years? You know, and when you look back at the Native American legends of these things, their stories of them, their recounting of how they lived side by side with them, man, there's a lot of history there, and people just can't seem to, once they get into it, they can't seem to walk away from it, feeling satisfied.
There's, I'm just the type of person where I, whether it's good characteristics or not of me or of mine, I feel like I'm going to have like a smoking gun experience to, in my heart of hearts, say that they're real. Like, it's right there. I see it. There's nothing else it could possibly be. Now, that being said, like when I have spoken to these hunters or different witnesses that I've spoken to and they've told me their experiences, and that moment, like I 100% believe them. It's like this weird dichotomy because I believe them, but I don't know if I believe it for myself. Like, it's very weird. I don't know how else to explain it.
You believe it as a truth for them, but you don't know that you can believe it as a truth for yourself. Is that what you're saying?
Well, kind of, except I think the truth is the truth. You know, like, I feel like in this case, it is, it's either real or it isn't. But I just, like, they are so convincing that I would never even think to say, oh, well, you're making this up or whatever. And they've seen it well enough that it can't even be mistaken identity. So I have a hard time, like, I have a struggle with, if I say I'm not sure if they exist, and am I calling them a liar, you know? But I'm not. I just, like, I feel like there's just this teeny weeny little bit of me that reserves judgment until I see one. And again, whether that's a good characteristic of mine or not, I can't say. But I have a little bit of skepticism left where could this not be real? I don't know how else to say it. But many, many, many days I'm like convinced. I kind of let this little doubt come in sometimes. Because like you're saying, I put so much time into this. My free time, you know, I have my full-time job and then I have two side hustles that I do. And then coming up here, like several weekends in a row, I'm going to be at these outdoor shows speaking and getting reports from people on my own time and my own dollar, because I want to know.
Yeah.
Because I want to know. But I just really, maybe it's just comes down to the point that I just like really, 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 really see one. You know,
how do you think you'd react to not being in a vehicle, but and not at 100 or 120 yards away, passing a indescript dark figure? Right. How do you think you would react?
I don't know, but there's a good chance I'll probably be terrified. I always say I'll probably be myself, but I've been in the woods, and I've been in the woods by myself and have seen black bear. When we were out in Montana, we saw a grizzly bear, but luckily it was kind of far away, So I do get startled. I have a bad startle reflex, and you know, it can be a deer that runs by. I'm like, ah, so I probably would have some kind of immediate terror. But when I have been, like, for example, I was on the Elk Scenic Drive in Pennsylvania. I did it by myself the one time, and I'm driving through and there's all these scenic overlooks that you can stop at to look for elk. And I went, got out of the car at one of them. It was kind of like a semicircle path you could walk along. And then there was a scenic overlook. Well, I get to the scenic overlook and it was awful because it was all overgrown and you couldn't see anything. But I heard something to my right and I turned and there was a pretty large bear that came out of the, you know, foliage and everything there out of the bushes and was standing right in front of me. And there was really, I was backed up against this scenic overlook, like, I think it was wooden, and it's standing right there. And, you know, I know enough about black bear that they're not like really out to hurt you or anything, but it's a very large, intimidating animal. And it was sniffing me, you know, and like the nose there and making noises and stuff. And I'm like, oh man. So I was scared, but I didn't move. People will say, well, more people get pictures of Bigfoot. And I'm like, man, I didn't move a muscle with that bear.
Yeah.
You know, I just had my camera in my hand because I was going to take pictures of the scenic overlook and I put it in my pocket because there was nothing. So I wasn't going to move. And I did say, I was like, hi, bear. I was like, please don't eat me. But it finally moved along and I waited. So I was patiently waiting and I went the other way. But I truly don't think I'm going to be the one that is brave enough to like start taking all these pictures and things, because I'll be like in a state of self-preservation at the moment. I would imagine. I mean, you never know until it happens, but I would imagine I'd be kind of scared and like waiting for the moment for it to not hurt me, and then I'd kick myself later. But
I think my optimal sighting would be like in a power line laneway, line cut, with it about maybe 75 to 100 yards away, I'm not moving. I got a good steady look at it. And, you know, it's, I've got a few seconds to get into the car if I have to, if it starts coming my way. I think that would be my optimal view of one. That sure. would be the most comfortable. Being in the woods, far away from your vehicle, that whole, hey, I see you peeking around a tree, and then it turns around and walks away. I don't think that'd be good enough for me. I would not be able to get out of there quick enough.
No, I know. Like I was camping with friends, and we were pretty remote, but I heard something scary sounding, and I had to like shuffle on over to the little bathroom area. I'm not the most brave person, that's for sure. I mean, I'm brave enough to do it anyway, and I love camping and I love solo camping. You know, I try to take precautions and all that. But so I'm brave enough to be out there. But yeah, if it came down to I walk around the corner and Bigfoot's there, I'd probably cry. More than just being honest.
Yeah, I think I don't know about the crying for myself, but I think there'd be a very good possibility that I would fill my drawers. especially if there was not an immediate egress out of the area that would suit my needs.
Yep. Well, I'm supposed to go to Alaska this June, and I'm trying to save up the money for it. For this like adventure of a lifetime that I was asked to go on, and we'll see if it happens. But we're supposed to take like two or three little jumper planes to the interior where we were supposed to be looking for Bigfoot, and it's like grizzly territory. And I haven't even confirmed that I'm going yet, and I still have nightmares about it. I'm like always a grizzly coming around the bend, but yeah, I'll need some Depends if I go.
Amy, what's some of the, what's one or two of the most compelling things that you've been made privy to that really just are something that your brain goes back to time and time again, that, you know, these things exist because.
The biggest one that popped out when you said that is when the one time that I've been out to the Nest area with the Olympic Project out in Washington State a few times now. And the first time that I was asked to go, which I was like, what? You know, like just even the fact that I'm a part of the group now. You know, I think I was telling the story about how I was never going to be in a group again. And then Derek and Shane called, and I'm like, okay, I guess I'm going to be in a group. But there, it's just a wonderful group. So I'm happy I made that decision. But I was asked to go out there with two of the primate zookeepers that are in Project Zoobook. And we flew out, and we were, you know, hiking around and everything. I had been up on like higher ground, and the two primate specialists and Derek, and I forget who else was there, that weren't any of us, had gone down the ridge down to where the certain nests were. And so I'm standing up there when they come back up. And I will never forget the look on their faces. And they're not, the Olympic Project doesn't say that this is for sure Bigfoot doing this nest making, you know, and neither were the primate specialists, but I will never forget him walking up that ridge, you know, from the valley, and they come up there, and the looks on their faces were just astonished. Like they were just amazed by what they had seen. And I looked at them, and I remember specifically catching my breath, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're real. Like, oh my gosh, like they're real. because these people work with gorillas and, you know, different primates every day of their working lives, and they were that
awestruck by it.
Yes, by what they had seen. Because I'm like, I'm an English teacher, you know, like I can look at it and be like, oh, that's really cool. But I don't know, you know, if that's it, how cool it is. You know, right. I don't know how cool that is. I'm a volunteer naturalist, you know, and I learn as much as I can. But I don't work with great apes. And so for them to be that excited about something that they had seen, you know, up close and personal, excited me. And I'll just never forget that moment, because like, oh, holy cow, like they're real.
So that the nest up there that you were seeing, is that, was that prior to the deconstruction of it and removal of it, or were there additional ones?
And that first discovery of the nest site, they found over 20, I want to say 26 nests, over 20 nests. And so at that time, I'm not sure how many they have, you know, gone into to try to get evidence at this point. But at that time, they had only disturbed 3 of them, I believe, because they, you know, in a perfect world, they could have just left everything alone and set up cameras and all of that and never had to worry about going in and touching the nests. But knowing that, you know, this is private property owned by a logging company that could come in there any minute, you know, they were given the opportunity to study these by the logging company, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, they needed to move in quicker than they wanted to. But, they got to see a bunch of nests, but they got to, like, really look up close and personal with some of them that they were trying to get evidence from. And it's amazing there. It's like you know, skeptical Amy was kept thinking, you know, could it just be people doing this? You know, like there could be a hermit that lives out there. Maybe they're doing this. But when you really see it and really look into it, like these nests, I really don't believe it's people. Like, I don't believe it's somebody just living out there. The nests are in so many different stages of degrading. They would have had to been there for really like years and years. There's nothing protecting you from the elements overhead. So a person, I think, would make, like, I could make a better shelter than that, you know, taking more survival classes and stuff, where I wouldn't want to be out there in one of those nests. But they're very similar to gorilla nests. And then I don't think it's a hoax, because, again, you'd have to be doing this hoax over years and years and years, with the likelihood of somebody ever seeing your hoax, like, almost zero. Like, it was a logging surveyor that found them just accidentally, an area that people just, you know, I was just about to say that people don't go to, but obviously he was there, so people do sometimes go to it, you know, but very infrequently. So it would have been the dumbest hoax ever, you know, so I don't know, but it's just, they're really fascinating. And the amount of scientists and people that have gone out to see them and their, what they have come back with is really remarkable.
What do you know as far as any of the evidence that they've gleaned from that? Has there been any anything that they've been able to pull out of there that they've had DNA tests done on? Or
they have hair samples, they've had foot casts and hand casts, lots of audio. It is not as easy as you think to get DNA from, you know, the type of hair that they're finding, whether it's degraded or just not the root of the hair, and it's expensive to do that. But there are ongoing studies being done right now, and they're trying eDNA, you know, where you can take the soil.
Right.
So there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And when I do speak different places, especially to people who aren't into Bigfoot already, because it's easier in a lot of ways to talk at a Bigfoot event, you know, because they already want to hear this stuff. But when I go like cold turkey and the guy in ahead of me speaking was speaking about coyotes and the guy after me is speaking about, I don't know, whatever guns you're going to use or whatever, I don't know. And usually it's always all men, like we were saying at the beginning. And I'm up there talking about Bigfoot. It is, I just lost my train of thought, but I think what I was going to say is that there is a lot. Yeah. I always tell the audience, there's like a lot of science going on behind the scenes in Bigfooting that people aren't necessarily aware of. And every time there's a lot of overlap between Project Zoo Book and the Olympic Project. A lot of us who are in the OP are also in Project Zoo Book and vice versa. And then we kind of have, you know, spread out from there. But, every time we've had a new scientist, and many of them are not into Bigfoot at all, and they're just like, okay, I'll come talk about this, or, you know, I'm a little bit interested. I don't think we've ever had one that didn't say that they had no idea what was really going on, and they had no idea how many eyewitness accounts there are, and the footprints, and audio, and all of it. You know, they just had no clue. They thought, like I did before, that Harry and the Hendersons was it.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's exciting. And as somebody who loves nature and animals and everything, I think, you know, I get excited if I see a bunny rabbit in the woods, you know, so to think that there could be something else out there is just that thing that keeps me going a lot.
I want to ask you a couple more questions and I'll let you go. You brought up an interesting point back when you were talking about the nest is, you know, we could have just put up cameras around that area instead of disturbing everything. That leads me to ask you, what do you think the issue that seems to surround this phenomenon about why trail cams and that kind of stuff doesn't really suss out any good evidence? It doesn't, you know, it almost seems like they're aware that they are there.
Right.
And I've heard, you know, and I've even references in other shows. It's like, if I came into your house and I hung a small 5-inch by 6-inch picture on one of your walls in your house, and without you knowing about it, and then you come home and you walk through your house, how long do you think it would take you to recognize that that picture wasn't there before and didn't belong and wasn't something that you put there?
Right.
I think if you look at the area of the forest that they live in, and that is their regular haunt, as it were, I think it would be pretty obvious that that would be something that they would pick up on, whether it's the smell of plastic, whether it's the sound of acute hearing the sounds of the electronics inside when they're clicking the pictures, or possibly the ability to see the infrared lights that produce a light in the evening in the darker time, so that they can be the pictures can be taken. I think from whatever reason, they're aware that they're there, and they avoid them. What are your thoughts on the whole camera thing?
Yeah, I would say pretty much exactly what you just said, that they're very aware of it. I would think. I personally don't think there are that many Sasquatch, maybe, you know, like to be on those cameras. So I feel like, I mean, we obviously have to have a breeding population, but I don't know that I think there are as many as some people do. I get that, you know, I'm sure you do too. That's probably maybe the most that and like, why don't we have any bones are probably the two most asked questions.
Right.
I always direct people to look into the Cross River gorillas. Because if you Google about the Cross River gorillas and the first time they were captured on video, it was just this century. And they're over in Africa on the border of Cameroon and Nigeria. They think, scientists believe that there's only 200 to 300 left of these gorillas, and they were a cryptid, you know, until not that long ago that the natives were just telling stories, but they're real. And so if you look up that first camera trap footage of these gorillas, they're coming out of the woods, you know, mostly females. And as they're coming out of the woods, they are all looking at that camera. So, like, they all see that camera. You can tell that they see the camera. So they're kind of coming closer and they're looking at the camera. And then from the back, there's a silverback that comes into view. And he looks at that camera and he bluff charges it. So I think about that. They're smart. You know, and like you said, you know, that's their home. They see something weird there. They're wary of it. He's like bluff charging it. And they know that that camera's there. And so I wonder, I don't know, but I wonder if perhaps these cameras make some kind of a noise, something that gives it away. Or is it just that they can see it from, you know, a little bit further away and they avoid it? That's what I think. Because we haven't gotten a lot of footage of a lot of different animals, not just Bigfoot.
Sure, yeah.
And if Bigfoot is closer to a human, then I think they're even smarter, you know. And it doesn't bother me, strangely, that we don't have it, because to me it kind of makes sense that we don't. But I get that a lot, especially with hunters. You know, I'm in these woods every day of my life and I've been everywhere and I haven't seen any, so they don't exist. And right. I'm just like, yeah, well, you haven't been everywhere at every time all the time. So
yeah,
it doesn't bother.
And you considering yourself in the, you know, I've been in the woods every day of my life hunting. Well, hunting right. season isn't every day.
Exactly.
You know, deer season is a short window of time. Bear season is a short window of time. Elk season is a short window of time. You know, so, you know, like,
the hunters are great because there's either the ones that laugh at you, and I do not care, obviously. Like, I laugh along. I get it. It's Bigfoot. It's kind of funny, you know, like, to them. Or you have the ones that absolutely, they're real. They saw one. It affected them. You know, it's just, they're so different. So different.
Interesting stuff, for sure. You know, I mean, with my show, like I said, might have been before we started recording, you know, I cover everything from psychics to remote viewing to Bigfoot and haunted houses and you know, everything. But man, I tell you what, when I have a Bigfoot episode, the audience spikes. It, you know, the listens go up. It's a very popular topic. You know, people are interested, and you know, it makes me wonder, like, the populace of just my listeners, it makes me wonder at times, like, the populace, are they more the Finding Bigfoot kind of crowd? Are they Mountain Monsters fans? Are they maybe more onto the YouTube documentaries that are, you know, some which are just god awful and clickbait and, you know,
all of it on
Amazon? You know, I've paid for some that is just like, okay, it was only $1.99, but I want my money back because it was that bad.
I bet you have a good mix in there. You know, I go out a lot wearing, I have too many Bigfoot hats, Bigfoot t-shirts, all of that. And it's not just myself, but a lot of us that are interested will wear those out and about. And I'm always surprised about getting reports just from doing that, or my Bigfoot stickers on my car, you know, like some up and they're like, I saw one, and they'll tell you their story. So I bet you have a lot of different people.
I'm sure that we do. I tried going on a date within this past year, and we ended up going to a pizza joint by the lake. And as we were walking in, a gentleman was walking out and he was wearing a Bigfoot t-shirt, and I had my Kreider exploration t-shirt on. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and I looked at him, and, you know, of course we both nodded at each other. And I said to the woman, this was our first date. I said to the woman, I said, hang on a second. And I turned back and I said, hey, you know, I wanted to talk to him about it. And I was saying, you know, hey, I'm hosting Bigfoot and Brews in Dowagiac, Michigan. It's only about 10-15 minutes from here, you know, just letting you know about it. And he's like, oh man, I'm from North Carolina. He says, I'm only here for the weekend visiting family and stuff. He said, I'd love to come, but I won't be here. And, and I can remember the conversation after that with the woman that I tried going on a date with. And, boy, what a tough crowd, man. She was not having any of it. And, I was like, you know, I said, you seem like a really nice person, but I said, if you can't even, you know, show a little bit of interest towards us, it's like,
right,
we don't have a chance in hell because this occupies a lot of my time.
Right. No, so. I hear you. That's funny. There's better fish in the sea that are open to business.
Amy, do me a favor. Let everybody know where they can find you, where they can find information about your groups that you're in, where they can find information about where you're going to be speaking. I might even talk to you a little bit later on about the possibility of coming to Bigfoot and Brews 2.
I would love that. That would be fun. You can get a hold of me at my email, bigfootamy@gmail.com. Made it easy, AMY. We are working right now on a website for Project Zoo Book. Our goal is that people can ask the different scientists questions. We have anthropologists, primatologists, primate zookeepers, wildlife biologists, marine biologists, all kinds of smart people on there that are interested in Bigfoot. Some who call themselves knowers because they've had their own experiences. So we really are working on that website right now. The Olympic Project has their own website if you're interested in that, and the NEST site. But yeah, I'm on Facebook, Amy Boo, B-U-E. So you can always message me or friend me on there. And, like I said, I have a lot of, outdoor shows coming up. I do different speaking engagements on that circuit. I've just been gearing more toward those, but I love the Bigfoot community, and I love to speak for that as well. I'm going to be speaking in Ohio at the Sasquatch Triangle Conference this May, and I do a thing in Mill Creek Park in the fall. I've had to say no to quite a few conferences because of the research that I'm doing. But I love to do both if they work out with my schedule. But again, I'm supposed to be going to Alaska. I hope it works out. Do you ever watch the show Alone?
I have, yeah.
The channel. So at one of the outdoor shows, I was invited to speak at one of my heroes, because I love, you know, this is like little Miss school teacher here who didn't know much about anything. And now because of Bigfoot, I've gotten this passion just for survival and taking survival classes and all this stuff. And so I met Roland Welker from season 7. He's from Pennsylvania, but he lives in Alaska, and he's who asked me to come out there. So we're trying to do a collaboration. If it doesn't happen this year, it'll probably happen next year, but I'm shooting for this year. It's just, you know, takes a lot of money, and I raise it myself. I fund my own research, and that's fine. I do what I can. And so I haven't done as many speaking engagements because of my actual research, but I love to do them too. So yeah, that would be fun.
Well, I've got one more question for you. It's a throwback to your anthropologists, your primatologists that that you saw the look on their face after having seen the nest. And I thought the word that you used was interesting. You said that they looked very similar to nests that gorillas would make. I'm sure you had a conversation with these people. Was it just similar? Or if they would have come upon those themselves without any prior knowledge to why they were there, would they have just assumed that they were gorilla nests? Or were they different enough to be, boy, these are really similar, but...
Yeah, I think they were different enough to think it was something else. I can't speak for them, but from what we've talked about, I think I'm safe in saying it wasn't like they thought like it was escaped gorillas or anything like that. They talked about how the formation of them, like if you look into the nest site, that original nest site, they were up on like finger ridges and they would all be positioned around the tip of the finger and down here at the edge of the finger and doing like this was a like a means of egress, really. It was a embankment down into a stream, like a salmon run stream. And so the way that they were set up with sight lines to each other, because one of our primate zookeepers has been over in Africa, so it's not just that they're working with captive apes, they also have been out in the wild with them too. And just the sight lines that they would make to each other was very similar. And the structure of them was very similar. And they said what was the most interesting to them, or one of the things that was the most interesting to them, two things. One was that they could almost see a personality in the different nests, like different creatures, whatever they were, had made them. Because when they are, you know, taking care of their charges, they'll say, okay, so-and-so made that one. We know, and so-and-so made that one, because they make it the same each time. So they could tell that some of them were made by the same creature. I don't know what else to say there. The other thing that they found really fascinating was that at least a few of the nests were very small, and they were up in some bushes and not very well made. And as soon as they heard about that and then saw it, they thought immediately of when a mama gorilla will teach their young how to build a nest, and they make practice nests.
Oh.
And so a lot of what we talk about between Project Zoo Book and the Limbic Project is about how perhaps these nest sites, because now they found the second one, could be maybe, could be some type of like nursery, like a birthing area. They're very remote, lots of food resources, a means of egress to get out of there if they're threatened.
But yet set up on in principle with a very good visibility all the way around.
To each other.
Yeah.
Like just to each other, like almost like for protection there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, one major difference is that gorillas, you know, primates usually make new nests each night, you know, and these seem to be a lot better made, where they would be something that was there for a long haul. But another thing that was interesting is that, you know, if you look at orangutans, they have young, I think it's like usually every 6 to 7 years. And that kind of, you know, rang a bell with looking at the nest site, that you could tell that there was a lot of time between the different nests being made, because some were pretty fresh and some were almost, you couldn't tell what they were.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, they would definitely have known that came upon them and that they were nests of some kind. Not a bear bed. They brought in a bear specialist, brought in a wood rat specialist, you know, brought in a lot of different experts in their fields to try to weed out what these are not. So whatever is making them, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Something cool happening out in the Olympic National Forest for sure.
Amy, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and doing this.
It's been fun.
It was a lot of fun.
And Thank you.
I'm sure my audience will appreciate hearing your perspective on it.
And I'll appreciate them listening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, dear.
Bye-bye.
Good night. All right, guys, that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Amy Boo. What an accomplished woman. And I hopefully will be able to bring you more female perspective on this topic in the future. If you did enjoy the show, please remember to leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you can, and share the show. Share it with your friends, share it with your family, share it with coworkers, throw it on your social media. Just get us out in front of more people. The more people listening make for more experiencers coming forward. If you've had an experience and you'd like to have it featured on the show, please get a hold of us at contact.uncomfortable@gmail.com. Or you can message me on Instagram or Facebook, both at UncomfortablePodcast65. And until next time, my friends, stay uncomfortable.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius, only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.